Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today, we're going to talk to a mystery writer. His name is Doug McGee, and he's written a book called Never Wave Goodbye. It's really more of a novel of suspense. Hello, how are you?
Good. How are you, David?
I'm just fine. Should we call this a suspense thriller, or should we call it a mystery? There is sort of a mystery element to it, but what do you think?
I think we're more on the side of suspense. I think there are some mystery elements. There are some things you don't know about, but you do sort of figure things out. At least a lot of the things out. And it wasn't my intent to withhold things and make it that the center of the book, but rather, you know, what's going to happen next and what's going to happen to the characters in the book, and so I would call that a suspense novel.
This is the ultimate what if. What if one of your children disappeared?
Right.
And, I mean, it's a horror that nobody wants to think about, but, I mean, I don't know how many kids are disappear every day, but I assume it's a large number. But you wonder, you know, what if I was in this situation? How would I react? What would I do? How would I even function afterwards?
Right.
And that's sort of what happens to Lena. Do I have her name right?
Yes, Lena.
Yeah.
I'm not giving too much away. I mean, you'll see it on the cover of the book, on the flap, that this is something that really could happen to anybody, because it's such a normal kind of thing. It's not the kind of kidnapping that you read about in where, you know, somebody is snatched off the street or something like that. In this one, a mother willfully gives her child to somebody she thinks has come from a summer camp to pick up her daughter, and it turns out 15 minutes later the real van for the camp shows up, and her daughters, along with three other kids, have been kidnapped.
And that makes it even more interesting, the fact that there's four kids who are missing now. And we wonder, you know, of course the whole book is based around, you know, what happened to them and where are they and will they ever see their parents again?
Right.
And in that aspect, it certainly is suspenseful. I found I love this book more than I thought I was going to like it, and I don't even know why I said I didn't. I don't know why I would say I wouldn't think I would like it. I guess I was online, you know, and reading some of the reviews, and it's so much better than any of the reviews I've seen online. It just is a very compelling book.
Well, thank you.
What I like a lot about the book is the fact that you write intelligently about characters. Your characters are very serious characters, and you make them very three-dimensional. We feel like we know Lena. We feel like we're feeling the pain along with her, and that's the sign of a good writer to me.
Well, thank you very much.
But is that difficult to do?
I'm not sure. To tell you the truth, what the difficulty of it is, it's what comes to me, and it's what sort of I see when I think about these characters. Maybe I should explain a little bit that I come from a background of journalism to some degree. I was a freelance journalist, photojournalist, and then I did two nonfiction books. One, a book of interviews with people on death row called Slow Coming Dark, and the other, a book of profiles of families of murder victims called What Murder Leaves Behind. And the book was essentially trying to look at what happens to people who have had this horrible thing happen to them in the aftermath of the tragedy. And so I think a lot of what I did in the novel is informed by the work I did on that book, What Murder Leaves Behind, because you know, we tend to categorize victims or people who've had something like this happen to them in certain ways. We of course we're appalled at what's happened to them, and we're afraid that it might happen to us as well. And yet they're, for the most part, they're not different from us. They're normal people put in extremely abnormal circumstances. And so I I think I drew on that, and when I was imagining these characters and taking them through this hell I put them through, I couldn't do anything but sort of try to cue to a realistic depiction of who they were, and I think to have done otherwise, to have sort of exaggerated things about them, or to have made their situations go from extremely highly dramatic to melodramatic, would have taken the reader out of things and not let the reader sort of feel what was going on with all these people.
And it's interesting in real life, when there's kids children disappear, it's amazing the neighbors that all come together, the people that suddenly want to help, really just want to give of themselves to help and try to find these children. And it's almost heartwarming to watch this on the news when you see it, and you see all these people who are out looking for the children. And the scary part is a lot of times they find them dead, and I don't know what the percentages are, but it seems like a lot of times when you hear a child's missing in the news, the child doesn't get found alive a lot of times, and you just can't. And I actually had this happen in real life. We had a minister whose child was walked to Sunday school and was kidnapped and killed in a Plano Park, and I still to this day remember. And the looks on their faces when I first saw them after it happened, and we actually went out to help them look for the children, and it just tore this family apart.
Well, that's a couple of things you said in there are interesting to me, that the neighborhood comes together. Yes, I think when the search is on and all that kind of stuff, the neighborhood does come together. What I found in doing the book of profiles of families of murder victims was that after the murder occurs, there is a strange thing that happens in a community in which people live. And you would think that, you know, that neighbors and friends and whatever would come, family even, would come and kind of circle the wagons and help out and do all this kind of thing. And it turns out in a lot of the cases, what happens is just the opposite, that people turn their backs, that they don't want to talk to the victim's family, because I think there's a subtle psychological thing there that says, I don't want to talk to them, because if it happened to them just down the street, it could happen to me. I was surprised by that when I encountered that, but I got it time and time again, where people said, you know, I would walk into their kitchen, say 3 years after their son or daughter was murdered, and they'd say, you were the first person who's come and really talked to us about, you know, what our experience was.
Now, I should mention, the book is called Never Wave Goodbye from Touchdown. I don't know if I even said the book title yet. I apologize. Doug McGee is your name, and it's Never Wave Goodbye, which is an interesting phrase. Was that phrase used in your family somewhere? It sounds like, you know, it comes from somewhere, that you didn't just make it up.
Well, it does sort of come. My wife's Norwegian, and she tells the story of her grandmother, which is sort of echoed in the book. She tells the story of her grandmother sort of admonishing not to wave goodbye, because, you know, when you wave goodbye to loved ones, they might not come back again.
Wow. That's what a sobering thought that is. But I mean, I've never heard that before. That's brand new to me. But you know, every family is different. Everybody has their little. It makes sense to some extent, but it seems very fatalistic too. You know?
Well, it's fatalistic. I don't know. You know, who knows where these folk tales and these superstitions come from? You know, but it seemed to work in this situation, because Lena, the woman who put her daughter on the bus, has two things she's really fighting here. She's fighting she's of course worried sick about where her daughter is, and she's an oncologist. She's a doctor, and she's a rational human being, and she has all her training has been focused on narrowing things down so that you can take all this information and get it to one sort of diagnosis and then work on that and somebody or help somebody, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the horror for in this whole thing with the kidnapping is that she can't do that with this information. She can't boil it down. It isn't a scientific investigation, you know. But so there's that, and then, you know, on the other hand, she's got to deal with kind of the guilt of what she did, although, you know, she was fooled by a very, very clever individual. She still, you know, has this guilt of having said goodbye to her daughter, and she can't remember whether she waved goodbye or not, and that sort of is part of her problem.
And it's interesting how they suddenly assume, well, I'm a bad mother, or I didn't do enough for my child, or I should have noticed all these things. But that's easy to say, but when you're going through something that you figure is just you're going through the motions, she's getting on the bus, it's just like any normal child would do. You don't realize, you know, that could happen to anybody. It's not a question of paying attention. Yeah, you always think you're paying attention, but yeah, there's always going to be a time when you're not.
Right. My experience as a parent, I have three boys, and I did actually put one of them on a bus to camp once, but it was a bus with a lot of other people, and it was nowhere near this situation. But I know in my experience as a parent that guilt is part of the deal. You know, you can do everything right, and you can feel like you're being a very good parent, and then something goes a little awry, and the kid gets in a little trouble, or if something happens to the child, or maybe it's like the school calls up and says, you know, your son is sick, and he had told you in the morning that he wasn't feeling good. You feel enormous guilt about that, you know, and then you take a situation like the one I put my characters through, and the guilt is just ratcheted up enormously.
It's amazing how hard people are on themselves sometimes. I mean, really, really hard on themselves. And yet, you know, you wonder why they are. I mean, why can't you let up on yourself? You know, and so many people can't. I mean, we all look at ourselves very critically. And it really is fascinating how we do that to ourselves. That we, you know, can make ourselves feel so bad about things that really are just out of our control. I mean, things happen. And, you know, they happen, I don't want to say they happen for a reason, I don't know. I sort of believe that, but I sort of think that we have some kind of control over something, you know. That's a whole other subject, but it's just interesting, and you have the four different sets of parents in this book and how they react to this situation.
Right.
And that's what makes it interesting, too. We get to see from all different perspectives what these parents are going through. And it's interesting that the fact that Lena is able to identify with some of the other parents.
Right. Well, that comes too from my earlier book, because my experience going around talking to people who had had somebody murdered in their family was that there was just a vast range of responses to that experience. There was a family in Philadelphia, which is sort of the basis for one of the families in the book.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
There was a family in Philadelphia that had just this horrible random murder of one of their sons. And, I mean, it's just a sort of an insane guy came up to him out of the blue one rainy night and just shot him, and there was no reason for it, nothing. It was just completely out of the blue, and the guy who did it was clearly just sort of insane.
Over the edge, yeah.
And the family, you know, had to deal with this. And of all the families I talked to, they were, you know, sort of the best equipped, I thought, to deal with this tragedy. But their response was widely different from that of people who just, you know, found out that their son or daughter was murdered, and it just broke them all apart. Just, I mean, there are statistics that say in the aftermath of a murder, divorce is about 50%, you know. I mean, 50% of couples who go through something like that divorce in the year afterwards. I mean, it just really you know, puts a knife in a relationship in a lot of ways. And for others, though, it's something that they can work through and get through. And, you know, there's no one way, there's no right way or anything like that to deal with a tragedy like that. And I use the four different couples to try to make that point.
I remember when my cousin, she was living on a street at one point, and she called her mother and said there one of the kids had been really seriously hurt on the street. It wasn't her, one of her kids, it was somebody else's. And it just really upset her to think that that could happen so close to home. I mean, that could have been my child. That right. could have been my child there. I mean, my child could be laying dead somewhere.
Right.
When I was growing up, you know, you let your child walk to school by themselves. We all walked to school by themselves. We never even thought twice that somebody was going to pick us up in a car and something was going to happen to us. And you never think that. You always, at that point, that mentality never went through my head. I never thought I was going to be abducted. But nowadays, you got to watch everybody all the time.
Well, I set this in Westchester County, which is north of New York City where I live, because, my older son was living there at the time, and I knew something about it. And also because it's one of those communities, there are hundreds around the country, that people move to when they have children in order to make sure that their children are safe, you know. And so it's that sort of irony, I guess it is, of people moving to a community, people living in a community, because they want to escape sort of the dangers of the city, and then they run into something like this. And I think that, you know, that's part of it too. I mean, that the people who devised this scheme to kidnap these kids were playing on the fact that that people living in a community like this are to some degree lulled to sleep, and if by sort of a normal kind of thing like what happens in the book, and so if you sort of go along with the norms of the community, in other words, you don't stick out or anything like that, and you just sort of pretend you are who you claim to be to these parents, they will be sucked in as these parents are.
Now you had told me before that you have written screenplays.
Right. I was my sort of route through careers is I graduated from Amherst College and went to Union Theological Seminary, which is a non-denominational seminary here. I thought I was going to be a minister. That didn't sort of pan out. I got interested in film and photography, and I worked for a number of years as a freelance photojournalist for magazines and things like that. And then I wrote the nonfiction books, and I did a lot of work against the death penalty. I'm opposed to state-sanctioned killing. I believe it should be abolished yesterday. And out of that work, I developed a screenplay about a photographer who was asked to photograph an execution. And that I wrote that screenplay, and it got bought, and it got made, and it was an HBO film starring Roy Scheider and Bonnie Bedelia. It was called Somebody Has to Shoot the Picture. And I've been doing screenplays ever since. I've had four films made. My last one was with Sissy Spacek and David Strathairn called Beyond the Call on Showtime.
Oh, that's cool. Now, how close do they actually come to what you wrote? I mean, do they make any kind of changes, or is it pretty much what you wrote?
They make many changes.
Do they?
Yeah. It's.
Does that frustrate you to watch that when you see those changes?
You know, it's understandable. It's the sort of deal you strike. I mean, you're essentially writing a blueprint for a film.
But is it easier to get published in book form when you've done screenplays? I mean, do they look more? Is it easier to get a book published because you've written before?
So I don't think so at all. In fact, I think there's something of a prejudice against screenwriters because, especially when it comes to fiction and novels like this novel, because the assumption is if you're a screenwriter, that you are essentially writing the novel to as sort of like an extended treatment for a film, and you're hoping that, you know, that it gets turned into a film. Now, I'm hoping that Never Wave Goodbye gets turned into a film, but I did write the novel as, hopefully as a novel, you know, and that works on that level, and then if it works as a film, fine, but I have friends, one editor at a publishing house who said that, you know, they get countless manuscripts from screenwriters who haven't really kind of made the transition from screenplays to novels and have sort of just, you know, you can see that it's that what they've written is a screenplay with some sort of different meat on its bones, you know.
Right.
And I tried, you know, I had done some other novels before this one, and, I mean, ones that are still in my drawer, and I had fallen into that trap several times, and so it took me a little while to make the transition from screenwriting, which is a very, very restrictive form. I mean, you have to, there are many things that you have to obey in writing those in order to attract a director, in order to attract stars, and, you know, you have to do all these kinds of things, and just to keep it in a certain space and time and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you can't go over 120 pages. A scene can't go for more than 3 pages, 4 at the most, you know, unless you're some auteur that, you know, anybody will make your film. But if you're sort of in the trenches the way I was, you have to hew to this form. And I didn't mind that. I kind of enjoyed that. But now that I've been writing novels, I see that as highly restrictive, and I really, really love the freedom that you have with a novel.
So what we see in the final product of Never Wave Goodbye is exactly what you wrote to a great extent. I mean, I assume they didn't change very much of it.
I didn't get much. It's just what I wrote.
It's obvious you know what you're doing. I mean, it's obvious you're very talented. You're a very talented writer because you know how to tell a story and you know how to tell it really well, and you know how to make it engrossing, and you've got all the elements down pretty well.
Well, thanks.
I would read anything more you wrote just because I enjoyed this so much, and I know, and I would trust you that you would tell a good story each time because I really think you're good at it.
Great. Well, thanks.
And if I had a say in your contract, you'd have a couple more books coming.
Well, this is a 2-book deal, and I have another one that's going to be out next June.
Is it what we talked about the other day, or is it something different? We really can't talk too much.
Yeah, I can't talk too much about it because it's sort of in.
All we need to say is that people need to read this book before we can talk about the other one.
Yeah, well, I hope people read Never Wave Goodbye and you know, enjoy it enough that they would want to read something more. Now, the plan is to do one a year, but you know, those things.
Is that hard to do, one a year?
No, it's not hard to do one a year for me. I write quickly, and it's the best way for me to write. I wrote very quickly as a screenwriter, and.
Was that a lot of pressure? I mean, it sounds to me like it would be a pressure-filled job to write a screenplay.
There is pressure. There is pressure often, but...
it's worth it in the end when you see your product up on the screen. I can imagine how thrilling that must be.
It was. It's always a diminution, though. I mean, you know, and even a book is the same way. I say this, but I don't mean this negatively. I just mean this to... maybe anybody who has aspirations to write or whatever. I mean, readers who say don't want to write or whatever. Readers are lucky people, I think, because they get to, you know, dive into a book and hopefully, you know, enjoy it and really, really come away with it. People who have aspirations to write, though, I think, you know, sometimes. You know, they have to figure out how it's done, or they, you know, they want to, I don't know, change things, stuff like that. And I'm sort of one of those kind of readers in a way. And as a writer, I really just want to get my story down, and I want to get inside this world and just stay in this world. And I find that the best way to do it is to just do it intensely. And the best way is to sit there for as long as it takes and just really, really involve myself in it, such that I see the whole thing and I hear the whole thing. And when I'm in those periods, it's difficult to read other things. You know, I read the newspaper in the morning, but I have trouble because I have to involve myself in somebody else's world, and I'm just more interested in this world that's popping up in front of me, and I just want to see where that's going to take me.
Now, could you ever adopt somebody else's book as a screenplay?
I've done that in my career.
Is that harder to do than to write your own screenplay?
To write an original.
Say if you were going to adopt somebody else's book into a movie. Would that be harder to do that than it would be for you to just write the screenplay yourself?
Write
your own screenplay rather than take it from somebody else's book.
Oh, I see. I think it's easier to just sit down and write your own screenplay.
Right.
You know, that is much easier. Adapting a book is, I think, a very difficult process. There are so many areas in which, you know, the two seem to be quite similar, but you're working in different mediums that are going to affect readers differently. I was writing something the other day about something that Sissy Spacek told me. She said I had made her cry too much. We were working on this film, and she said I'd made her cry too much. And her point was that when you're watching somebody on the screen, you don't want to watch them cry, because then they're having the emotion for you. You want to watch them either fight against the cry or something like that, or resist the cry, so that you can feel what they're feeling, and maybe that will evoke tears with you. But then I realized that in a book, in Never Wave Goodbye, I had my characters crying at times, and I think it's a different sort of deal there, because you've already establish for the reader why this person is crying, and when they actually do break out in tears, they're earned. The tears are earned, and the audience, the book audience, the readers know why this is happening and know the emotions and go along with it. So then when you're going the other way, if you're taking a scene in which somebody cries in a book, you've got to figure out a way to make that, have those same emotions come through on the screen and with the audience.
And I find that Lena, who turns out to be the most interesting character in the book, she's the mother of one of the children. You do so much with her. She goes through so much during the course of this book, and we really get to see her agony. And I really like that. I really like, because you know, you don't know how the book's going to end when you're reading it. So you just have to play along with her. I mean, you're in essence living her life with her, because you don't know what she's going to react to everything. I mean, everything that happens, she sometimes looks at it both ways. It could be really good or it could be really bad. Maybe my daughter's dead somewhere, or I don't feel my daughter anymore. And you go through, you see all these things she's going through, and it's very, very well done, because I think that's what happens. I mean, not that I've ever experienced it, but I can't imagine that people don't go through exactly that when their children disappear. All these things go through their head, you know. I did something wrong, or I, you know, or maybe that means they're dead. Or, you know, all this horrible stuff goes through your mind, and you just can't stop it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then,
yeah, I mean, you know, you've got, you put your finger on it. I mean, the ambivalence that somebody feels in that kind of situation is as crippling as the not the ambivalence. I'm sorry, that's not the right word. It's the sort of ambiguity of the situation that it isn't. I mean, you get in the middle of that and you think, well, there's good guys and bad guys and that kind of stuff. If you're seeing it from the outside, or if you're seeing a normal Hollywood film or whatever, you know, there's black hats and white hats, and if I were with the white hats, I'd know exactly what I felt and what I needed to do. But in truth, you don't. In truth, you question yourself, you question the authorities, and you feel that you're right, and then you feel you're wrong, and you're on this roller coaster, and the only thing that's going to get you off is a resolution, and you both want the resolution and fear the resolution, and it's just a horrible situation to be in.
And the father, and it's interesting how the males are always react differently than the women do. I mean, you always get this. It's rare to see a man that gets as emotional as his wife. For some reason, I don't know whether it's just human nature that men are much more calm outwardly. You don't want to lose it. I mean, you don't see it. How many times do you see a grown man crying like that?
Yeah.
I mean, at all. You don't really see it very often at all. I mean, I know I don't. And, you know, when you see it in a movie, it's very unusual to see. I mean, I still remember the scene from Adam with Daniel Cervantes where his son gets kidnapped from Sears. And the agony that he shows in that hotel room after they find Adam dead is just unbelievable. I mean, you don't see scenes like that in films very often, especially with men.
Right.
It's well,
I found one thing in my research for the book on murder victims' families that was that something I probably should have realized before. But men, first of all, when something like this happens to them and their family, men are quite reluctant to talk about it. And in fact, there was a woman in Indiana who had been lined up on, you know, a sort of part of a Manson sort of style killing, and her four teenage sons were shot dead, and she was left for dead, and she survived.
Wow.
And I talked to her about 4 years after that tragedy. And she said that after we talked for about a half an hour and she told me how it happened and all that kind of stuff, she then told me that I now knew much more about what had happened that night than her husband did.
Huh.
That he had just refused to talk about it. And
they withdraw into themselves, which so many men do. I mean, they just totally withdraw.
Yeah, I don't...
Is it just because it's too much for them to handle thinking about it?
Well, the reason I think is that,
but doesn't
I'm not crazy about, you know, making huge differences between men and women in this regard, but I think that men have a feeling toward family and children that is probably hardwired from ages ago, which is I need to protect this family. My job is to make money, you know, hunt and gather, and protect this family.
Right.
And when there is a breach in that, when somebody comes in, you know, kills a son or a daughter or whatever, that is just a horrible, horrible sort of thing for somebody who has felt that it's their job to protect the family. They have not done their job, and a loved one is gone. And it is just such a horrible wound for somebody like that. Now, mothers, of course, you know, there's mama bears and, you know, all that kind of stuff who are ferocious in protecting their families, but I don't think they might carry the same, you know, horrendous guilt in that regard, because they might feel they've done all they can or they tried or something, whereas men, on the other hand, are often left with this, you know, this failure. This is a huge, huge failure, and it's in a very, very basic way. It's not like they've lost this job. It's not like they've, you know, didn't attend a little league practice or something like that. They let their guard down, or that's the way they see it, and all of a sudden one of their children is dead.
Now, there's a school bus on the cover of the book. Now, there is no school bus in the book, really. It's just a camp bus. Now, you have a story behind that.
Well, you know, it's sort of a publishing story more than anything else. Yes, there and a couple of people reviewing the book have mentioned the fact that the bus on the cover isn't the same as the van in the book. I will say that when I got the proof of the cover and saw it, my first reaction was exactly that, and I ran up against the wall of opposition because everybody in the marketing department and advertising and all this other kind of stuff said that would sell the book. I mean, that the image was so clear that children were in trouble. That spoke to the fact that children were in trouble, and if you just had a van, you wouldn't get the same sort of emotional impact. So this was I'd run into a lot of this stuff in screenwriting where you had to make compromises for marketing and all that kind of stuff.
It's hard to say no when they're going to publish your book, you know. Even if they want to, it's hard to say no, you know, when you want the book published, and it's a book that's well worth reading. I mean, it's fantastic. So, you know, you want people to read it, and you don't want to.
Well, there's contractually too. You know, I don't know. I don't know what I could have done to do it. You're essentially, you sign a contract with a publisher to have them publish your book, and you do sign away some sort of decisions like this, and you just sort of trust that everybody's going to work in good faith, and they have. I mean, I've been very happy with my publishers, and my editor is terrific, and it's been a wonderful experience for me, and I wouldn't cast any aspersions on them for this. It was just their decision to make, really. I mean, they were trying to put some covers on what I had written and make it, something that people would be attracted to. And so...
It does convey the essence of the story nonetheless, even though it isn't a school bus in the book. It's still there, and the story makes sense in the story. You know exactly why the cover's like that. So, I mean, it isn't going to... People aren't going to say, well, that just ruins the book for me, because the book is so well-written anyway, and it's not going to matter once you finish it.
Right.
And that's how I felt, and I know everybody who reads it's going to feel the same way. Because it really just is a good book. And it's a great book to take to the beach and read. I mean, it's fantastic. You know, it's a quick read, too. And it's just a really interesting story.
Well, I appreciate that, and I'm glad to hear that, and hope other people feel the same way and enjoy it as much as you do.
Now, what exactly do you do when you're not writing? I mean, do you have a lot of hobbies? Do you have time to do other things, or is writing pretty much most of your life?
No, I have time to do other things. I do still do film and photography, and I work on some film projects and write some screenplays and try to get things going there. I've got a TV series that I would like to get off the ground if I could.
Can you talk about that at all? I mean, can you mention what it's about?
Well, it takes place in a law clinic in a law school, and it's a clinic set up to try to exonerate innocent prisoners. And the lead professor who runs the clinic is an extremely conflicted man who has a huge secret himself that he's keeping, almost like the fugitive. And so it's both about trying to exonerate people who are innocent and about this man's this professor's journey.
Do you think it'll make it to television?
I don't know.
I think we all know the way the business is, up and down. You never know what's going to be on next. David E. Kelly's got another law drama coming on in the fall, I see. I was reading about that with Kathy Bates. And, you know, it's just one after the other. And, I mean, how many, you know, and you have to make it interesting. To me, when I watch the pilot show, I've got to like the characters. I've got to be interested in what happens to the characters next. If I'm not, I can't watch the show.
Yeah.
And to me, that's everything. I mean, they have to be. That's why I like Damages. I love Glenn Close. As evil as she is, I mean, she's totally evil. But she's fascinating. She's a fascinating evil woman.
Right.
And
that's an interesting form. You know, I've never done a series, but I would love the opportunity to. It is an enormous amount of work. It's just unrelenting for months and months on end. I know that from friends who do it, and so there is a part of me that wants very much for this series to get picked up or to get even, you know, optioned or anything like that, but there's also a part of me that says, if it does, I'll have a tiger by the tail.
Now, will all the books that you write from this point on be thrillers, suspense and thrillers? I mean, is that where you want to stay?
I want to keep doing probably one of these a year. I have plenty of other ideas for different sorts of books, and
well, when you say you have an idea, do you have the whole book planned in your head, or is it just the idea of what it's going to be about?
No, you know, with any project for me, I'm not a big outliner and that kind of stuff. I usually have something that really excites me, like an image or a character or just a situation or something, and it just interests me enough to say, I would like to go into that, and I would like to just see what's in there and do that. And I'll jot things down and have them for years. Never Wave Goodbye was an idea I had for a screenplay back in, maybe 10 years ago. And I had an agent at the time who I pitched it to, and pitched a sort of general idea to, and she said, oh, no, too many characters, and blah, blah, blah. And I literally just sort of shelved it on that little thing. And but I had told my wife about it, told my wife the idea, and I was sitting with her one night, and we were talking about things, and I said I was thinking about starting another novel, and that I had this idea, and I told her an idea that I wanted to do, and she said, well, that sounds okay, but what about that camp story? Wouldn't that be a good novel?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how we got going on this one. So
and it's very effective.
Lovely Mary Hedahl, her name is Mary. I should take much credit for this book and all sorts of things in my life.
So you didn't outline this book at all. I'm amazed.
No, I don't outline. I have little points that I know about. I know, you know, where I'm starting. I have a general idea of where I'm ending, and I'll have little images that I know are going to come in there somewhere, and then I just sit down and write. And as I go along, things start popping up, and I find it best that to do that way, because it keeps things a little more spontaneous. And, you know, I have outlined, when I first started doing screenplays, I was sort of forced to outline by some producers who worked that into the deal, that you had to submit an outline before you could go on.
Mm-hmm.
And those things were not good because what I find is when I get into a story and when I start writing, and things present themselves and characters, it's a cliche, I guess, that characters speak to you and
sounds like a jigsaw puzzle that falls into place a little bit.
Pardon me?
It sounds like a jigsaw puzzle, and you're putting the pieces into place gradually, and everything starts to fall into place. And you know, and it's amazing how books get that to be that way after they're done. You think, wow, that was pretty well put together. You know, I mean, some endings don't make any sense at all. Your ending made much sense to me. I was, you know, and I was very satisfied with it. And that, and a story like this could easily have a bad ending, but it didn't. And I really applaud you for that, because, you know, if it has a bad ending, it will ruin the book for me, and I think for a lot of people too.
Well,
so now everybody out there wants to read it, and I hope they do, because it's wonderful. But we've just about run out of time. It's been wonderful to talk to you, Doug McGee, and this book is, I wish you all the best with it. You certainly have enough blurbs on the back, and it is a terrific book, Never Wave Goodbye. It is out in all your bookstores from Simon & Schuster, Touchstone, and thanks for being here.
Thank you, David.
This has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.